This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe. I hope that everybody's doing well. I hope that you've grabbed a nice beverage, whatever you choose, and that you're going to just sit back and relax. Tonight, I have a great guest. His name is Glenn Parris, P-A-R-R-I-S, and he is a writer. And we just discussed the distinction between being a writer and author, but I'm here to really talk to him about something he's been doing very, very recently. And he's working on a series, an anthology called, and you'll correct me, Glenn, if I get it wrong, okay? Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda. It's an anthology. And we're into something these days. I think everything's, bringing a lot of attention to black people, for various reasons. But in Hollywood, movies are starting to take a sort of a different slant, and writers are turning up and writing about different things. I met him through Kim McMillan of, I gotta get this right too, Black Afrofuturism. She's of that fame. And I was very privileged to host a panel of authors, of writers that wrote comic book series. Now, I'll also mention that, and I'll tell you this later, that Glenn has another profession as well as being a writer. So, Glenn, I hope I didn't butcher your introduction too much, but introduce yourself to the audience and please tell them about your writing, because you really do have a lot to say. I'm very impressed with everything that you do.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for having me on your show.
It's my pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to come to New York, even if it's only virtually.
Yes, it still counts. We still count it.
So you covered a lot of ground in that introduction. I thank you very much. So I am a writer. My writing is through the lens of my background. I am African-American, of course. So when I write, I write with all that baggage that comes through me and through the ancestors. Sometimes you're a little uncomfortable about being labeled an Afrofuturist. I am an Afrofuturist, absolutely. But I have to define Afrofuturism as speculative fiction, whether it's science fiction or fantasy, through the lens or through the collective experiences of the African-American diaspora or the African diaspora. You know, I have some Caribbean background as well. There are those who are Afro-European, whether it's, you know, whether they grew up in Germany or England. And wherever our folks end up, you know, we carry a little bit of the culture, the history, and the legacy from the motherland to wherever we're going.
So you've actually incorporated into your latest work, it sounds like, because I did listen again to you, and you went very deeply in your writing called Dragon's Heir, and that would be H-E-I-R. And tell the audience more about that, because I was really fascinated by how you were able to interweave all these very significant subject matter into this one topic.
Thank you very much for introducing that. So Outland Entertainment is my new publisher, and they're in the process of editing Dragon's Heir. And I believe that they plan on releasing it either later on this year or early next year. But yes, it's a science fiction novel. It's in many ways, it's allegorical. The whole process of landing, incursion, colonization, and the whole notion of disrespect—I don't want to say disrespecting the cultures, but sort of diminishing native cultures. So, I wanted to sort of display what it's like to be contacted by a very powerful culture, a culture that doesn't necessarily have an understanding or even care to have an understanding of our culture or the native culture, and how that plays out in terms of power, in terms of dominance, in terms of negotiation, in terms of decision making. And all that sounds very political, but I wanted to make sure that those who've never experienced being colonized, being objectified, being exploited, could appreciate being in that position as somebody who has absolute power. You know, when you don't necessarily have control over your own bodies, your own destinies, your own families, your own life. So it touches on that, but it also gives the flavor of, you know, the typical science fiction trope, you know, the space opera, the landing and the travel in a foreign land, you know, the connections between disparate peoples who have certain things in common. There are certain things that are just universal to people. And the perception that, you know, you do things that are indifferent to people that hurt them, and you don't experience guilt for it. And a lot of that's in Dragon's Ear. And I look forward to that being published. I look forward to that conversation that it may spark in some of our readers someday.
Well, you spoke about a lot of interesting things, and that's why I listened to this panel. So everybody on the panel was excellent, but you spoke about some things I thought were very, very deep. You went as far as Atlantis, and you spoke about slavery, and then you spoke about Harriet Tubman. And I mean, I'm thinking this guy is like really deep. I mean, just like untangle my mind a little bit about all of this, because some people might find it, wow, this is a comic book, a comic series or animation. How did you get all of these things all tied together and make a cohesive piece of literature?
Well, you know, I've been reading comic books since, you know, in grade school. Always loved them. And the thing about comic books that I love the images. I love to try to draw them when I was little. But more than that, I've always loved the story. And if there's a story that I can relate to, you know, a hero having a problem, a hero having to make a decision that his superpowers couldn't solve, you know, he had to solve with his heart and with his mind, and sometimes he has to compromise. You know, so those different concepts are what helped me shape stories. In Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, I have a short story called The Underside of Darkness. And it's the story of a Black Panther ancestor of T'Challa, who in the MCU was played by, you know, the late Chadwick Boseman. This entire anthology is really a tribute to Mr. Chadwick Boseman, who he lost far too soon.
Yeah, that's shocking.
Yeah, in my story, I call back to Challenge Day to ground the reader in things that they may know about the Black Panther pantheon. I then introduce a little something of Europe. You know, Wakanda has remained a secret civilization for thousands of years. And they've always been technologically far advanced of Europe and Asia and, you know, the Americas in terms of their technology, their medicine, their politics, their civilization, their economy. So I wanted to create a clash between them. This young, new Black Panther is challenged to keep the Western world from discovering and interrupting and maybe invading Atlantis that might trigger a true world war where every person on the planet has to be recruited to fight a battle against the overwhelming forces of Atlantis. So I would like to see, you know, the challenges of a superpower, a true superpower, that has to make geopolitical decisions on a regular basis, and at the same time, hide its hand. So, you know, the United States and Russia and China and England and France, we've always considered them the superpowers, but they operate, for the most part, in the open. We know who they are. We know what they can do. How do you navigate a superpower like Wakanda that has to remain secret? No one is supposed to know that they exist, much less know about their technology, and where they are and what kinds of arrangements they have with other powers on Earth. And I would imagine that they would have to have representative spies to tell them about the outside world and help guide them in terms of, okay, this is leading down a dangerous path historically. We've got to do something about that. I would imagine that they would have to deal with those kinds of problems on a regular basis for all of their existence and watch the rest of the world slowly catch up with Wakanda. You know, the development of fossil fuel-powered engines and vehicles, the development of nuclear power, threat to the environment, the incursions into the ocean, and then again, you know, their rivals, Atlantis, could be disturbed and pushed into an aggressive position. You know, negotiating all those things that the United States has to do around the world. You know, it can push back. It has military might, but it has to extend diplomatic pressures on different friends and rivals around the world. So, you know, imagine a country that's much more powerful than the United States, more technologically advanced than the United States, but has to also remain hidden. And I thought that'd be a terrific challenge I have to write about.
It sounds very challenging. It sounds very interesting. I think that there are people of color, minorities, people of color that have had powers or had talent, and they've had to remain hidden about it. It's almost like it's something metaphoric about it to me. When, you know, somebody can't express how smart you really are because of, you know, bigotry or because of politics or whatever your hidden agenda is or someone else's. I think that it's interesting also, and I'll share this with the audience, is that you're actually a rheumatologist. You're a physician.
Yes, I am.
So your characterizations of just the action in what you write and the characters are very reality-based, makes it very believable.
I do like to sort of leverage my education and my experience when I write, putting some realism in and try to give details that make it not only believable, but hopefully interesting for the reader to incorporate into the story.
And you talked a bit about trying to portray, or I would say trying to portraying the acts of violence and writing it well. And could you expand on that a little bit? Could you sort of elaborate on that?
Sure, of course, I'd love to. Yeah, you know, it's, you know, everybody's got a pet peeve when it comes to books and to movies and all kinds of things. Well, one of mine is the whole notion that, you know, the hero gets injured, he gets shot, he gets a broken leg or an injured arm or something like that. And two scenes later, he's using that arm, you know, to fight off bad guys, or, you know, going across a river of lava. You know, people don't heal that fast, even with a heart-shaped herb.
Yeah, well, I imagine that you probably know what really should be happening. I know there was some banter about that on the panel. And do you use your background? I guess that's a dumb question. Of course you use your background to write about acts of violence. And you said something else interesting in that interview. You said that you're anti-violence.
I am. You know, I've worked too hard at trying to help put people together from man-created violence to natural violence and illness and injury and disease. And, you know, I've often shared with patients the number of things that have to go right every time you open your eyes in the morning and get out of bed is astounding. To think that someone can execute an act of wanton violence or reckless endangerment to other people and have no consequences, and think, oh, well, in the next episode, they'll just get right back up. They won't have a scratch, no scars. You know, they'll be fine. That whole notion, I think, feeds into the desensitization that we have these days to violence. And, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, it's why we can, some people think that, you know, you can watch a public execution live on television and think it's okay.
Right. And think that, yeah. And some people would think, I'm thinking about what we've read in history books about hangings and people like gathering for a hanging. And I don't believe that that's a deterrent to violence, and it's not okay. And so how do you reconcile in your mind and your heart?
You know, but even more than that, you know, the idea that you can watch somebody who's been captured and slowly put to death, and it's all right. You know, we've seen this in the news over the past several years. It's not something that happens in every case. It's not something that happens every day, but it happens all too often. And the cavalier nature of the act is what has always bothered me. You know, the weapons that we've created are not toys. The amount of destruction that a firearm can cause is devastating. The amount of destruction a simple blade, a knife, can cause is devastating to an individual, to the family. And hopefully, if the perpetrator has an ounce of conscience, hopefully he won't be able to sleep nights because of it. Hopefully it will haunt him. Because I think that if you are bold enough to take a life like that, hopefully it leaves a scar on your soul. And that's something that when I write, I like to put those kinds of things in. Taking a life should never be a trivial pursuit. It's something that, you know, if it has to be done, and I can imagine there are situations where it has to be done, but if it does have to be done, it needs to change you. It needs to be something that you carry with you for a long time, because it's that serious.
You spoke about experiencing and actually witnessing and dealing with in your medical practice, even though you didn't mention being a psychologist or anything, but you mentioned the psychological consequences and emotional scars due to violence. And then you're writing about it. My thing is you're writing about it. And so how do you balance? What's the balance for you in writing about violence and actually dealing with the consequences of violence?
Well, as a novelist and a short story writer, a creator of any kind, you know, there's a certain amount of entertainment that you have to build in. I'm not here trying to preach, per se. I may sound a little bit like that, but I'm not here trying to preach. I do want to entertain. But at the same time, you know, I can't ignore, you know, the reality of what happens when, you know, you get into a fist fight, you get into a fight with a stick, you get into a fight with a blade of any length, you get into a fight with firearms, bombs, cannons. You know, there are consequences to those things that you can't just brush off, you know, as the explosion happens in the background while you walk in slow motion, you know, into the camera. That kind of thing, it's not real, it doesn't happen. Anybody who's been in the theater of war will tell you that's not what it looks like, and that's not how you walk away from it. You know, if you have people who have really been there, nobody really wants to be in that situation again. You know, even people who've gotten very good at it. You know, it's just not a thing that should be romanticized. So even though I do romanticize about it in writing, I try to inject a little bit of realism into that as best I can.
Well, tell the audience a little bit about, I'm going to be transparent. I have not yet read the book, so I don't like to pretend that I've read the book. I know a lot of people can interview and pretend they read the book, but I have not yet. I've read about the book and I've heard people speak of the book. Tell the audience a little bit about the character in Dragon's Heir.
Ah, okay. So the character in Dragon's Heir, it sounds sort of fantastic, but, you know, I've often thought, you know, what happens once, if it happened once, it could happen again. If it happens again, then maybe it already happened before. So in Dragon's Heir, my character is an archaeologist, and she is of an aristocratic caste, and she finds herself on a scientific mission back to a place where her people have come from. And her people left their homeworld millions of years ago due to the consequences of an industrial accident that they themselves caused. They call their world Fitu. We call their world Earth. So these people are descended of the dinosaurs, and they come back to Earth, and they're looking for untainted organic material that potentially can save them from a cosmic pandemic. When they arrive on Earth, expecting to find this desolate world, and they're looking for fossilized DNA, they find it, you know, burgeoning with life and brimming with vegetation. And the lowly mammals that they left behind to die have evolved over 65 million years to look very much like them.
Oh, surprise.
So you can imagine the curiosity, a people who think that they're the apex civilization of all time, coming back to find what they considered, you know, little more than bugs that have evolved to look like them and have certain differences. You can imagine the curiosity of, how did this happen? Why do they look like that? How smart are they? You know, do they have the same beliefs that we have? Do we have to accept them into our civilization? And then, you know, certain feelings and concepts and attitudes start to creep in. It's, how dare they think that they can join us? They're not as good as we are. And, you know, you start getting some bias, some prejudice that start creeping into the interaction between those people and human beings.
So it sounds like you're taking human beings off of our high horse, because we think that a lot of people believe that we're the only form of life in the universe.
Correct. And so do they. And so do they. And when they see a people who are limited to one world, and they only have supersonic aircraft, and they only have, you know, gigabyte or terabyte computers, and they only have 600 languages, and they can't, they're not telepathic, and, you know, they don't have faster than light travel, you know, and they don't have all these things. It's, well, it, you know, it's yes, it's cute. They've got this, but, you know, that they're not really civilized.
That's, I think it's really outstanding. I'm always fascinated by people that can write the kind of fantasy that the panel was discussing. I'm very intrigued by the fact that you use what you actually do, which is like, I guess is your profession, and you're able to integrate it into the creative side, which I consider what you do on the creative side. I think it's a curious thing that as a kid you read comic books, and at this point you said that you started writing later in life. You said you started working at 36 years old, and you considered that later in life, where a lot of people don't start until much later than that. Was it something that you had an inkling to do all along?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I went into the sciences because I didn't like writing papers. I didn't like literature, homework assignments, and analyzing stories. I didn't feel comfortable with it, at least not when I was in high school and college. And I think over time, as I matured, you know, I developed a different appreciation for alternatives to reality. So a lot of what I've been in were alternatives. So we have, for example, a healthcare system that's very, very complicated. And we try to help everyone, and unfortunately, we end up with a two-tiered system, those for the haves and those for the have-nots. What if there was an even more advanced civilization who decided that, yeah, we'll develop medical technology, but, you know, you only get it if it serves the greater good. As an individual, either you survive your illness or your injury or your age, or you don't. And if you don't, we just move on. And, you know, nobody's irreplaceable. It's a choice. It's a choice. These people will literally watch one of their fellows die if, you know, they get injured or they're sick. It's like, you know, that's on you. If you survive it, fine. You know, we're here with you. You know, we'll bring you some water. We'll, you know, give you a break. You don't have to work while you're dying. But if you don't survive, you know, we may have the medicine or the techniques to help you, but you're weak. We don't want to preserve weakness. We only want to preserve strength. So survival of the fittest taken to the nth degree.
Yeah, it's like beyond Darwinism, really. I think sometimes, you know, the people can be. It's interesting. It reminds me of, well, I've seen vultures watch a fellow vulture die and they're all like hanging around. I've seen, because where I live, I see things like that. And they're watching this vulture die and they're just sitting there watching, and then somehow they know it's dead and then they go in for the kill.
So, you know, the technology that they develop and the attitudes that they have, the motivations that they have, are very, very familiar to many of us. You know, it's a little uncomfortable to watch, you know, these people come back to Earth and watch what motivates them to do the things that they do. Some of their emotions, some of their mores are very familiar, uncomfortably familiar. And then some of the others are, they're more honorable than what we do. You know, the interesting thing about them is I wanted to make them consistent. And the consistency shows a lot of traits that, you know, we might find admirable and some that we might find despicable, but they're all consistent. I thought it'd be an interesting way to develop a story and a people in a world.
What I thought was very interesting that you spoke of is you talked about Hollywood not really giving anyone anything cerebral to watch or think about. They kind of dumb it down. And you said that you were really anxious to present something that provokes thought. You know, you don't want to make it so easy. I mean, I was a college professor for a while, and I found there were students that had like a lazy mind. And so you kind of have to prod them, not like with an actual cow prod, although sometimes I felt like I wanted to do that, to get them to just think for a second, trigger a brain cell. Do you feel that Hollywood was, this is a question. Do you think that Hollywood was not ready for something as deep as what you produce? Because I know the people on the panel were I was impressed with the level of intellect with creativity. And I'm wondering, perhaps the reason they never did a Black Panther series written by a Black person is because they weren't ready for that level of intellect. And I can sort of, I want to agree, you know, but what do you think?
Well, I agree with you. I think that Hollywood underestimates the public in general, not just Black people, I think in general. I think that the public, the world public, is ready for more complicated stories from people who are not of Northwestern European ancestry. I think that people of Northwestern European ancestry are ready for stories from people who are not of their culture to learn more. You know, in ancient times, you know, if you were traveling through Greece or Rome, the biggest thing that you could offer in exchange for food, water, and wine was a good story of a faraway place.
Oh,
you could talk about an empire in India or a kingdom in China, or in West Africa, or East Africa, or Egypt, or a faraway place. If someone came from the Toltecs or the Mayans or the Aztecs telling stories about that civilization, you know, I think, you know, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, you would have a European royal court just wrapped with these stories that would be just unimaginable. They you know, treat you like a king just to get you to tell more stories. And I think that they've missed that. I think that African-Americans and Africans and Afro-Caribbeans, Native Americans, Latinx and Asian-Pacific creators all have wonderful stories to tell that are unique culturally but relevant generally to everybody, because these are human stories. There are a certain number of ways of solving any given problem. And we use different combinations of those tools, but we're all kind of limited to the same tools. We speak verbally. We have nonverbal communication. We write with some kind of characters or ruins. And, you know, we all like stories. It's universal.
What do you think about the, you know, so I'm not, like I had admitted at the panel, I'm not really into comic books and even animation to an extent. I do appreciate animation. Do you think that the Black Panther, the movie, the original movie, opened up some minds in the world? What do you think? Do you think that you feel that your work will be more accepted because of that?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, my story in the anthology is about you know, a cold war between two incredibly advanced superpowers, Atlantis and Wakanda. And I believe there have been some, you know, what Marvel likes to call Easter eggs, talking about perhaps Atlantis and Namor, the Submariner character in the Marvel Universe, may be the next antagonist for Wakanda and the Black Panther. I think that would be a very interesting situation to explore, but make it more about the people and the history than about the boom bang of the technology. You know, all that is great, but what people always remember is the story between two characters or the family of the two characters, the heritage of two characters, where that comes into conflict. Leave room for the complexity of interpersonal relationships, because that's what makes a story timeless. Technology has a shelf life. So, you know, you can have ray guns, you can have spaceships, you can have tanks and ships. That technical aspect of fiction is nice and it's you know, memorable, but what people will always remember is that Greece went to war with Troy because Paris kidnapped Agamemnon's or Menelaus' wife, Helen of Troy. We remember that. We remember that Odysseus was arrogant and the gods sent him off on an adventure where he was wandering the world for years before he was allowed to come home. You know, those are the fact that he fought a giant, the fact that he fought harpies, the fact that he was bewitched by a sea witch or the siren song, you know, those are things, the challenges that he faced on the way home are what we remember. That's what's been memorable for 3,000 years. It's really the development of character and the interaction of character in setting that I think makes for great stories. And I think that, you know, my long-winded answer to you is Hollywood is learning. There are fewer simple half-hour, hour-long, self-contained stories, and there's more of an arc where, you know, the characters and the stories continue from one episode to the next, or there's a longer story in a feature-length production where it's much more complicated and you get deeper into the characters' psyches and histories and profiles, bias, and the personal things that make them feel like a three-dimensional being.
Yeah, that's what I think people want to feel. I noticed there are a lot of younger people are into this gaming, and also, I guess it tends to be a bang, bang, shoot 'em up sometimes very much. And it's such a trend. But I like the fact that what you're doing has a purpose to it. It's not just indulging yourself in violence, which is what we see so often. They'll indulge an audience to get a certain audience. They'll put something horrible, some horrible violence to see. When you say that you're anti-violence, so in a comic book such as Black Panther, you're going to expect some kind of violence. How do you reconcile that with yourself? Is it because, well, I don't want to answer it for you, but how do you reconcile that with yourself? I'm thinking in my head, you are a physician. You've seen the result of violence physically and psychologically. How do you reconcile that within your writing? You know, you can tell me what your version of that is, what you really feel. I know what I'm thinking, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth.
Well, first of all, you know, when it comes to writing, you have to have character, you have to have conflict, and that conflict has to sort of ramp up to keep the attention of the reader. You know, otherwise, that's not particularly interesting. So you have to have some kind of conflict. You have to have a challenge, and you have to have your character grow in some way when he faces a challenge. In many of our hero, superhero, or even, you know, mundane, smaller stories, you have characters who have interesting talents, but those talents are challenged and really tested, you know, to the letter of what a person can do. And at some point in the story, it should become almost insurmountable, the task that they're up to. And you know, we have the same kind of thing, but as a creator, I think that the challenge is put that in there, but make it believable, and, you know, make the audience feel what the main character feels. And I think that's the challenge. You know, in The Underside of Darkness, you know, you have the third son of the king who's fighting to become the Black Panther. So there are all kinds of doubts. You know, why not the first son or the second son? You know, the third son, you know, is usually relegated to certain diplomatic functions and showing up for different social affairs. You know, but to be the Black Panther and to be as young as this young man was when he rose to that mantle, it was questionable if he could manage this kind of a challenge. So, you know, we put him to the test. And, you know, he had to make certain sacrifices that he didn't anticipate making. And, you know, he's got to live with those sacrifices. You know, and so it showed a certain amount of maturity. But, you know, he's questioned by even his Dora Milaje guards at some points. You want to make conflict, but you want to make it logical. So, you know, again, to your point about violence, you know, you can have conflict without violence sometimes. You got to have something kind of sexy, kind of exciting, but you want to have something that sort of exercises the brain as well as the muscle.
Well, I have to say, Glenn, that just hearing about this, I definitely will, you know, seek to read as much as I can. I mean, I'm one of these people that gets like loaded down with a lot of books, and I tend to be one third into all of them or half into all of them. But it sounds very inspiring. And I'll say that had I had something like this to read when I was a youngster, I think I might have gotten into comic books. But there was nothing like this out there.
Let me just say this about comic books. When I read comic books, I really appreciated really good artwork in comic books. But to be honest, the art simply inspired my imagination. It didn't define my imagination. In between the panels in a comic book, I'm putting all kinds of things into motion, you know, in my mind. And I think many young comic book writers, readers do that. We're not looking at picture one, picture two, picture three, flip the page, picture one, picture two, picture three, flip the page. For us, as we're reading through it, in our minds, you know, we've got a little model of what we start with, but we build that up into really vivid characters that we can almost hear talking. A lot of what I think people who watch anime or read comic books do in their minds is so much more than what's actually on the page. If you can appreciate the art of writing such short fiction, if you condense all the words in a comic book, they probably fit on one page, maybe a page and a half. You can tell a whole story by adding some of the highlight of the images of these characters as imagined by the artist that works with the writer, or the writer-artist in some cases.
Well, I can imagine I have listeners that are just dying to contact you. How can someone contact you and see your work? You know, do you have a website?
My website is very simple. It's Glenn Parris, GlennParris, because I'm double trouble. I've got a double N and a double R, and it's .com.
Okay, GlennParris.com. And what can we expect from you next? Because I know that you're affiliated with some really great people right now, Kim McMillan and Lucinda Clark. So what are the plans? What are their plans for you?
Well, I write in several different genres, and my biggest challenge is finding the time to sit down at my computer and write. So let's see, I've written three novels, one of which is unpublished or in the process of looking for a publisher. If you know anybody, I'd love to talk to them. I've worked with my publisher, Outland Entertainment, for my science fiction. They're excited about that. They're excited about the prequel and the sequel to that, which I'll be working on later on this year after I get this this project with them off the ground. And I write some historic fiction. So, you know, like you with your reading, I've got about 50 pages written on a historic fictional novel that I look forward to finishing. I think it's a good idea. I think that the characters will be very interesting to read about, and I hope everybody enjoys the story.
It sounds so fascinating. And I'm always impressed when I see, especially, it's funny, you don't always think about men writing things like this, even though we know that men always write things like this, but it sounds so sensitive. When I was listening to the panel, there's a sensitivity that I picked up through you, definitely, especially as you were praising fellow panelists, Kyoto. And I thought it was very interesting. It sort of touches a part of you when I watch these things and listen to people speak and hear their stories. I really wish the best for you, and I really would be so happy to see your story get out there, because I know that there are a lot of young people and people that are not so young people, and they're not anyone, that would be very inspired by the work that you're doing. Because it seems that you're onto something. I think a lot of it has to do, as I look at it from the outside, with your background as a medical professional as well. And it does add to some of the realism of what your work is. I've seen this in other authors. And I would love to invite you back on the show to talk about your next project.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for that invitation. And if I may, in parting, say, bartenders and doctors get to hear some of the most intimate things about people's lives, things that they would never tell perhaps friends or coworkers or even certain family members. You know, we hear some really, really intimate things. And the old cliche that truth is stranger than fiction is so true, you'll never know. But in my experience, you know, I talk to and work with people of all kinds of backgrounds. Different nationalities, different ethnicities, different religions, different belief systems. I talk to and work with people who are, you know, of course, male, female, transgender, intersex, gay, lesbian. You know, I work with everybody. And the people that I work with are more than just their label. If you have somebody who's trans or somebody who's cis, do they work together all the time? Is that an issue? No, it's not. You know, does it have any bearing on their skill as a professional, as a lawyer, as a peace officer, as a physician? It doesn't. And once people get that through their head, you know, you sort of get a chance to move on. Okay, I can depend on them because they really know their stuff when it comes to A, B, and C.
Well, your open-mindedness and your willingness to accept people for who they are, I'm sure and I know for a fact that it contributes to genius. And again, how could someone reach you if they want to reach you? Just to repeat it, I want to make sure they can get to you.
I have a Facebook page, Glenn Paris Fiction Writer, as opposed to author, glennparis.com. If you want to look at some of my body of work, you can find it on Amazon. Put in Glenn Paris in book. A number of my works come up. I've got to make sure I get a couple of other things on there that aren't there. And you know, just keep an eye on what I have coming out. I've got a number of things in the fire that I'm hoping that people will enjoy and appreciate.
And I see the screenplay is about to be written by someone's going to write it. I kind of see what you do being right on the big screen. Even if it's just about you, you know, I think that the fact that you're right and what you do makes you a superpower as well. And I thank you so much for coming on the show, Glenn. This was really inspiring. You know, I feel I need to stop and just read one book at a time instead of trying to read five at a time, because I really want to read this. I'm excited. And I really thank you so much for being part of the panel with Kim McMillan and also coming on to interview with me on the Energy Stoners Cafe, and try to get some of your writer friends to come on as well. I thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Tony. Have a great evening.
You too. And I'll say goodbye to the audience. Thanks for coming to the Energy Stoners Cafe. I'll be back again. As you know, I come back every week, and be well, be nice to each other. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.